Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Master. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who is the author of a new book, The Politics of Truth, Inside the Lies That Led to War and Betrayed My Wife's CIA Identity. Ambassador Wilson was a career United States diplomat from 1976 to 1998. During Democratic and Republican administrations, he served in various diplomatic posts throughout Africa and eventually as ambassador to Gabon. He was acting ambassador in Baghdad when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. In February 2002, he investigated reports of Iraq's attempt to buy uranium from Niger. We'll be talking with Ambassador Wilson. And then in the second half of the hour, we'll be talking with Lieutenant General William Odom, who's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a visiting professor at Georgetown University. He formerly served as the director of the National Security Agency from 1985 to 1988 and taught at Yale University from 1989 to 2003. He's also stepped forth as a retired military officer, as a four-star general, Army general, to suggest that the United States withdraw from Iraq. So we'll explore why he thinks that the United States should withdraw from Iraq. I'm speaking with Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Ambassador Wilson?
Yes,
this
how
is,
are you
How
today?
Are you? It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's good to be with you.
Obviously, this has been a bad week for the president, and in particular for Secretary Rumsfeld. Prior to this, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak said America's situation in the Middle East has never been worse. And, of course, it's taken a massive nosedive since then. How do you see this this scandal playing out? Do you think that Rumsfeld will be sacrificed? I mean, he's already fallen on his sword for the president to the extent to which he's basically taking the blame. I mean, personally, I find it difficult to believe that the president didn't know about this.
Well, and I think what you have here is a political scandal of tremendous international import. It further destroys whatever limited credibility we had left in the Arab part of the world and weakens us with our traditional friends and allies. And it makes a mockery of our statements that that we could do things outside the context of the Geneva Convention, but still respecting the rights of people in our custody. My own sense of this is that there has to be some political accountability. This is a matter of national security and U.S. Reputation internationally. And as a consequence, I believe that Rumsfeld should not resign, but that the president must fire him. Now, that said, this president has demonstrated time and time again that his loyalty to his senior staff is far greater than their loyalty to him, and I don't know if he's going to see fit to fire him or not.
Well, wouldn't it be difficult for him to fire Rumsfeld, given that the Democrats have called for him to be fired or removed, and that would therefore, the Republicans are not about to fire him at the behest of the Democrats?
Well, that's certainly the argument that the Republicans are making, but this is not, as I said earlier, I don't believe this to be a partisan matter. I think this is a matter of national reputation, the reputation of the United States internationally, and you cannot hope to begin to improve those so long as you have no political accountability for the scandal that today in Britain's newspapers is called in headlines a catastrophe. You can only imagine what the Arab newspapers and the rest of Europe's newspapers are saying about this.
Well, also, this story could have legs, as they say, because Rumsfeld said in his testimony that there's a lot more pictures and a lot more videotape out there. So presumably the agony can go on for some time.
And that's exactly right. One of the things that the United States has generally been pretty good at is facing up to issues like this and acting decisively. So long as we're not seen to be acting decisively, I think that this will just go on and on and on.
Let me remind the audience again, if I may. I'm speaking with Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who is the author of a new book, The Politics of Truth, Inside the Lies That Led to War and Betrayed My Wife's CIA Identity. Ambassador Wilson, do you believe that this administration, as many have said, is, you know, the president himself, is, in his interviews with Bob Woodward, suggested that he talks to God. So he's got this faith-based kind of foreign policy that that has led to this situation in Iraq. But on the other hand, there are many indications that Karl Rove in particular indicates a tremendous pragmatism and perhaps even cynicism. So my question is, if this thing gets worse, is it possible that the president will, if Karl Rove says, look, we're going to lose the next election, we're not going to have a second term, we got to ditch Iraq. This is a millstone around our necks where, you know, there's no way that we can win as things go from bad to worse there. Do you think he's capable of doing the very thing he said he wouldn't do, which is cut and run?
Well, I think more than likely what you're going to end up with is this rather rapid transfer to partial sovereignty and then a garrisoning of the U.S. forces who will be brought out only in times of absolute need to deal with insurgencies.
Now, do you believe that the transfer of sovereignty at the end of June will make things better and dampen down the tensions?
Because what I think it will do is it will allow us to begin to say that this is the Iraqis' problems, and then ultimately, if in fact you have the outbreak of civil strife, you will have what Rumsfeld has already been talking about, which is. The line of argument will be, well, we gave them all the tools that they needed in order to remake the country in their own image, and they just simply weren't up to the task. That's the excuse after this is all over. That's the line.
Well, the other line is, though, that everything that's happening in Fallujah and Najaf and the increased body count, the month of April being the worst, worse than the war, the numbers in the war itself, what the administration is saying is this is proof of the desperation of the insurgents as the deadline nears for the handover of sovereignty. I'm suspicious of this. I think it may be just rationalizing the fact that things are getting worse. What's your take on that?
Well, I wrote as long ago as last September that when Mr. Wolfowitz testified that all we needed was to project a little bit of confidence that this was beginning to sound an awful lot like Alice in Wonderland.
I guess the indications are if this is not, as the administration is trying to say, a increase in violence ahead of the transfer of sovereignty, if the sovereignty is transferred and there's some doubt to whom, who this sovereign entity is, would you expect the insurgency to continue?
Well, I think the insurgency will continue until there is seated in Iraq a political power that is able to exert monopoly control over the use of force. Now, that could be a very long time, what with the proliferation of militias in the hands of all three of the confessions, as well as the scramble for position within some of the major cities, including not just Baghdad, but Kirkuk, for example, which is on the border with the Kurdish area and is the petroleum capital of the central northern part of the country.
And of course, that's one of the ironies or paradoxes of this situation in Iraq. You've got essentially a one-resource economy, and as nature has bequeathed, the oil in the south is in the Shia area, the oil in the north is in the Kurdish area, and the Sunni area in the middle, they're out of luck.
That's correct. Historically, of course, Iraq has been much more than a one-resource economy. It is, after all, the breadbasket of Mesopotamia. They have a tremendous agricultural potential, and they've shown an amazing adeptness at manufacturing, reverse engineering, even during the Ba'athi regime. So there's a lot of potential there. The question is, how do you develop the economy, and how do you sort of restore stability, and then put their talents to good use.
Well, what you were there, you essentially turned out the lights in the United States Embassy in 1990 at the beginning of the first Gulf War, after having spent a lot of time extracting your colleagues from the American Embassy in Kuwait, which was overrun and surrounded by Saddam's forces. And in your book, The Politics of Truth, the Ambassador Wilson, you described this a whole chapter. And it's fascinating reading. And just one of the things I wanted to touch on, because I'm interested in talking more about the stories of the day, particularly this prison story. But one of the urban myths that sort of developed out of the first Gulf War is the notion that April Glaspie, your boss, the ambassador to Baghdad in 1990, that in her meeting with Saddam Hussein, a meeting which you attended, she supposedly gave him the green light to invade Kuwait. Now, your book reveals, in fact, that's a bum rap for her. But there's actually more evidence that a subsequent letter from President Bush was not sufficiently tough. In fact, it was unnecessarily conciliatory. That may have emboldened him. Plus, visits from United States senators like Alan Simpson, who's almost acted like a supplicant, Howard Metzenbaum, a supporter of Israel. Simpson's case, he basically said to Saddam, you know, the problems you're having is because you're getting your bum rap in the press, and boy, do we know about how bad the press is. So, I mean, it's a pretty sad catalog. So can you walk us through that? Because, sure. It has become a kind of urban myth that somehow April Glaspie is responsible for Saddam invading Kuwait.
In fact, just to clear up one thing, I was not at that meeting, but I was there at the embassy when she wrote her reports, and I have, having worked with her every day during the 2.5 years I was there, I knew quite well from her what U.S. policy was on inter-Arab border disputes, and which what it was historically was we don't take a position on the legal merits of either party's case. What we do is urge you in the strongest possible terms to resolve them diplomatically. And that's what she said in the meeting, and that's what the Iraqis heard. In a lunch I had with somebody who was at the meeting, a former ambassador to the United Nations in the U.S. and who was undersecretary at the Foreign Ministry at the time, Nizar Hamdoun, I met with him for lunch about 3 months before he passed away in New York in the spring of 2003. He actually passed away in July 2003. And during the course of that lunch, he told me, reconfirmed to me, about that meeting, that Saddam had not been looking for a green light or a yellow light, and he got from April precisely what he expected to get, which was a recitation of U.S. policy. What Nizar told me was that when they received the letter from President Bush a couple of days later, that's what surprised them, because that was the opportunity to be a lot tougher. Now, I put that all in there for the historical record, because I think historians will be talking about this forever. It's not a dig at the first Bush administration or the first President Bush. It was a letter that was drafted at the State Department, and other people, when they go through and do the history, will be able to come up with exactly how they came to the conclusion to use the language that they did. But one of the things, more broadly, as I look through back at this period with the benefit of hindsight and with the benefit of being not in the fulcrum, it struck me that, in fact, it's easy to see how the Iraqis would have been confused about what U.S. policy really was, given that we were projecting a number of different interests simultaneously to them. Some of them were tough. Some of them were rather soft. You mentioned the visit of the senators, which was intended to be tough, but in the end ended up being soft. But we also had extensive trade relations that we were developing on the one hand, and vitriolic editorials from the Voice of America on the other. So it's easy with the benefit of hindsight to see that there must have been some suspicion and some confusion on the part of the Iraqis as to what we were about. That doesn't, of course, excuse their invasion of Kuwait, nor does it excuse any of the actions that Saddam Hussein, a certifiable sociopath, had been doing.
And indeed, the person who seems to have gotten hung out to dry and conned in this was Hosni Mubarak, who I believe, was it in the meeting that you had where he took the phone call from Mubarak?
Or was that was in the meeting with Ambassador Glaspie. But I think that very clearly what he said to President Mubarak was by his own admission, what he also said to Ambassador Glaspie, which was that he was not going to invade so long as there was a negotiating process ongoing. And I think that, to a large extent, explains how and why President Mubarak was so exercised after the invasion of Kuwait. He, too, felt betrayed.
And in your meeting with Saddam, did you feel that you were meeting with a sociopath?
Well, I certainly felt that I was meeting with somebody who was able to construct a logical argument, but it was based on illogical premises, and as a consequence, the conclusion of his argument was did not stand up. But it was clear to me that Saddam wanted to do a basic deal when he met with me. One, he wanted to tell us that he was going to keep Kuwait, and if we let him keep Kuwait, he would give us oil at a good price, as much as we wanted, and serve as our ally and policeman in the region. And two, if we tried to drive him from Kuwait, he didn't believe we had the political will or the intestinal fortitude to suffer the number of losses we would inevitably suffer, and spend the time that we would have to spend in order to dislodge him from Kuwait. In other words, we had neither the intestinal fortitude nor the stamina for the job.
So do you put down his lack of reality, the fact that he was a despot with unlimited power and he kind of had an echo chamber of sycophants, that there was nobody around to tell him that this was a bad idea?
There was nobody around him to tell him that there was a bad idea, that's clear. He was limited by his own sense of historical perspective, which was really Iraq-centric and with a limited understanding of even the rest of the region worked. The lessons that he had drawn from history were the wrong lessons. It was a classic case of acting on bad information. You end up getting a bad decision.
Well, fast-forwarding now to the present. President Bush and his entire administration have not come to any consensus as to why we went into Iraq. They keep changing their story. Initially, it was to look for weapons of mass destruction. Then it became to sever the link between, the alleged link between Saddam and al-Qaeda. And more recently, in his last public appearance, President Bush said we're obviously better off without Saddam because there are no rape rooms and torture chambers in Iraq. And, of course, that is now blown up in the president's face. He no longer has that last straw to rely on. So just in a broad sense, you were there under this psychotic mafia type of operation that ran Iraq. It was often referred to as the Republic of Fear. Obviously, it was a horrible regime, and the Iraqi people paid dearly for this psycho's actions. You know, a million people died in the war against Iran, and then this ridiculous attack on Kuwait caused more suffering for the Iraqi people, and they had 10 years of UN sanctions. Given that they were liberated from this monster, how could the Americans have blown it so badly?
Well, I think we just totally misunderstood the dynamics of the region. We failed to understand that Iraqis are a proud people who have bridled under occupation since 1258 in the fall of the caliphate at the hands of the Mongols. I like to point out that even if they had been willing to greet us as liberators, within 3 days we would have had to prove that we were not going to be occupying in order to retain that loyalty.
Now, didn't General Garner more or less want to do that?
I think he did, but as in so many cases, the administration didn't listen to people who had reasonable and practical ideas. The State Department had put together a great blueprint for how to transfer sovereignty quickly, peacefully, how to restore basic services, and the administration, the Pentagon in particular, simply rejected it. In fact, I have written that it seems to me that a disinterested observer could conclude that this reconstruction program has been so badly managed by the Pentagon that failure is an acceptable outcome for them, that they may be setting themselves up to fail. They've managed it so badly.
And what possible strategic logic is in there in that?
Well, there's not much strategic logic unless you think that what you're doing is precipitating the partitioning of Iraq into three countries, which then eliminates some of these larger countries that historically have been aligned against our strategic ally in the region, Israel.
So, in other words, having a vacuum in Iraq, an unstable vacuum, it therefore destabilizes the neighborhood and perhaps could lead to a battle between Shia and Sunni?
Yeah, I think the theory really is not so much a vacuum, but that you would have an Iraq that either peacefully or through civil strife would become three countries, which would be split essentially on along confessional or ethnic lines. So you'd have a Kurdistan, a Sunnistan, and a Shiistan. But just by virtue of the political dynamics, they would be as suspicious of each other as they are of anybody outside that their immediate borders. And that then would eliminate a significant threat to Israel. Now, I think it's first of all, we didn't test that thesis in national debate before we went and did this operation. It has now cost us close to 800 soldiers and $160 billion, with another $25 billion to be spent before the end of the year. But secondly, I think it's very problematic as an outcome that this in any way enhances the security of our of the region or of our ally.
Yeah, but if what you're saying is true, Ambassador Wilson, then the neocons conned us.
Well, I think it's very clear, and I've said in my book, I find the neoconservatives to be a parasite that found a willing host in the Republican Party. Their loyalty is not to traditional Republican values. Their loyalty is to this vision of how the United States should be dominating the world during the period of an American imperium. And if you read Max Boot, they're quite explicit. The idea of establishing an international consolidary so that we can stride across our empire in jodhpurs and pith helmets, much like the British did in the 19th century.
But if that was their idea, they've actually undermined. In fact, a subsequent guest, General Odom, makes that point, that they've actually undermined the notion of American empire.
Not only have they undermined the notion of American leadership by going from hegemony or American influence to American imperium, but more to the point, they have undermined all our interests in the region. I believe they will have undermined Israel in this idea that you can recreate the Arab world in its pre-Ottoman state. And I think that they have very clearly, by their actions and by their promoting of this policy, unleashed a growth, a spurt in anti-Semitism globally. And that's a terrible, terrible thing.
I'm speaking with Ambassador Joseph Wilson, the author of a new book, The Politics of Truth, Inside the Lies That Led to War and Betrayed My Wife's CIA Identity. And Ambassador Wilson was a career United States diplomat from 1976 to 1998 during Democratic and Republican administrations. He served in various diplomatic posts throughout Africa and eventually as ambassador to Gabon. He was the acting ambassador to Baghdad when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. And in February 2002, he investigated reports of Iraq's attempt to buy uranium from Niger. And, of course, that has led that the fact that you did that and that became a contentious issue because of the inclusion in President Bush's State of the Union address saying that that other intelligence services had warned or told the United States that Saddam was trying to buy yellow cake from Niger. And you were sent over there prior to this to disprove this. The fact that it got in a president's speech became a bone of contention. You subsequently wrote a piece in the New York Times, essentially outing yourself, and then the White House retaliated by outing your wife. Where does that stand? Because there is a investigation going on.
There's an investigation going on. There's a grand jury that is sitting, and I have absolute confidence in the special counsel and in the FBI team that's working with him. The fact that we have not been able to bring this to closure 9 months after the outing indicates to me and most people who are looking at this that the White House is stonewalling.
And it's pretty clear, at least there seems to be a consensus that the leak came from the vice president's office, specifically John Hannah and David Wormser may have been the ones that did it, but they were doing it, obviously, you know, it's like that Henry IV. Will someone rid me of this troublesome priest? In this case, will someone rid me of this troublesome diplomat?
Right.
Obviously, the orders came from above. And in reading your book, I get the feeling that maybe Rove, who initially tried to encourage the press to trash you when he was told that what outing your wife was actually breaking the law, he backed off. Do you think that this is a case of overzealousness in the vice president's office, or do you believe that it's that the president, I mean the vice president and Rove, and therefore the president, are on the same page?
Well, I think that once they realized what they had done, they really stopped trying to do it, and now we're just playing defense on it. With respect to the vice president's office, it's very clear from what everything I've heard that it was a deliberate attempt to, that dated back several months, to run an intelligence operation against me, to collect all the information they could on me, and then be poised to use it against me in the event that I went public with this, which what happened to be the truth, which is that the 16 words, as the White House admitted, did not rise to the level of inclusion in the State of the Union address. Then they pounced because somebody decided that the political agenda that they were defending and promoting was more important than the national security of my country. And there you have it. There we are.
Well, one of the things, you know, I'm reminded of Carville's James Carville's adage about it's the economy stupid. I mean, in some ways, it's the stupidity stupid, because even if the story about the yellow cake from Niger were true, it wouldn't have made any difference. I believe that didn't Saddam have like something like 500 metric tons of the stuff sitting around in a warehouse somewhere?
Yeah, he had stuff under seal, under IAEA seal, but it would have made a difference in that had he, in fact, been attempting to procure yellow cake from Niger or any place else, it would have been a clear indication that he was doing what the vice president accused him of doing, which is reconstitute his nuclear weapons programs. And so that's why it's so important. The President of the United States made part of his argument based upon the threat that Saddam was going to come at us with a nuclear weapon. Hence the we can't wait for the smoking gun be a mushroom cloud conclusion. Now that conclusion was based on a couple of facts or a couple of assertions. One was that we had found some aluminum tubes that could be used for centrifuges to process yellow cake and turn it into fissile material. And the other was that Saddam was trying to purchase fissile material from, or yellow cake rather, the raw material from Niger. Both of those turned out not to be true. Hence, the entire case for nuclear weapons was untrue. And nuclear weapons, as I like to remind people, really is the doomsday scenario. That's the threat to our society, the existence of our society.
Well, in closing, Ambassador Wilson, let's go to the sort of the real question here, which is, and we'll be joined in a moment by General Odom, who has called for the United States to withdraw from Iraq. And he's a former four-star army general and former head of the NSA. So, I mean, in a way, we're in this mess because nobody thought about the day after, meaning the day after the successful military operation. And, of course, it should have been pretty obvious to everybody that the United States was going to beat Iraq. They already had beaten them once before. So the notion that there was any mystery about the outcome of the actual military operation should have been of minor importance. And the day after should have been of major importance. So let's go to the day after. If I'm right and the Bush team are sufficiently cynical to declare victory and get out in order to get reelected, what would happen the day after?
Well, I think that unless we leave a reasonably stable political and economic environment, the sectarian strife will begin almost immediately as the different factions go at each other for control of the nation state of Iraq. That then would lead to a multifaceted civil war in which either one faction would emerge victorious, or more likely you would see the splitting of the country into three. And this would not be a divorce, at least three. This would not be a divorce like the Czech Republic and Slovakia. This would be much more like former Yugoslavia and the Balkanization of Iraq, with all the instability that comes with that. Now, I think General Odom, for whom I have tremendous respect, offers a new line of discussion in this. And I think it is probably about time for us to discuss the whole consequences, the risk benefits of what we're doing, in somewhat different terms from what we've been doing traditionally. It seems to me there is very little chance that we are going to succeed in implementing the president's vision. So what we need to be thinking about is how to mitigate our losses, given how far our credibility has declined, and how limited our options are.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Ambassador Joseph Wilson.
Well, it's my pleasure. You're my hometown. I'm from that part of California. Look forward to being back out there.
I hope we get to hook up again.
And I do, too. It's good being with you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
I'm Ian Masters. I was speaking there with Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who, as a United States diplomat, served from 1976 to 1998 during Democratic and Republican administrations. He served in various diplomatic posts throughout Africa and eventually as ambassador to Gabon. He was the acting ambassador to Baghdad when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. And in February of 2002, he investigated reports of Iraq's attempt to buy uranium from Niger. I'm now speaking with General William Odom, who is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a visiting professor at Georgetown University. He formerly served as the director of the National Security Agency from 1985 to 1988 and taught at Yale University from 1989 to 2003. He's also the author or co-author of a new book, America's Inadvertent Empire, published by Yale University Press. And in terms of our inadvertent empire, let me just quickly read a passage here from your book. You say that if the United States were to retreat to isolation, is to advocate the diminution of the wealth of both the United States and its allies. To insist the United States conduct its foreign policy mainly on the basis of unilateralism is to promote the destruction of the American empire. To pursue the expansion of democracy without first achieving constitutional breakthroughs is to increase the prospects of tyranny. To assume that international markets can work without governance is to invite economic decline in international trade and investment. To fail to recognize the many different roles that military power plays in sustaining the American empire, especially as a substitute for supranational political military authority, is to risk unhinging the present international political and economic order. Now, that reads as a catalogue of everything that the Bush administration is doing wrong. And why is it there, therefore, that this disconnect, that on the one hand you have the evidence that you're suggesting in your book, it's counterintuitive to the notion of American empire. At the same time, the political left in this country, and more importantly, the real political left in Europe, thinks that President Bush is the poster boy for American empire.
Well, the confusion is use of the term empire, and I was reluctant to use it, but it's used so much that I decided to redefine it. And if you notice the definition, I'll briefly go over the three terms I put for it. It's not territorial, it's ideological. It's a community of states that share liberal, and I mean capital L, liberal principles, constitutionalism, rights. Democracy will inexorably occur if you become liberal. It won't inexorably become liberal if you are democratic. And the second point is that it has thus far been a money-making empire, whereas all others tend to exhaust themselves by losing money. And third, until recently, countries have fought to get in it, not to get out. So it's, I think, the disconnect here, both in the on the part of the critics and the Bush administration, is they have not really examined the nature of this American power. If you add it up, as I point out through several of the gap chapters, how much of a gap there is between the U.S. and the rest of the world, and then an even more amazing gap between what you can roughly call those people within this informal international system that I've called an inadvertent empire, and the rest of the world, it's staggering. It has 70% of the world's gross product. No empire's had that kind of no political institutions, set of institutions has been able to amass that kind. The difference is, it's an empire which you can't dictate. It's an empire for negotiations. It's an empire for understanding shared interest. And the reason it has not bogged down like the League of Nations and other international organizations of that sort is the American national portion of this empire is sufficiently great that we can, in behind the scenes and other ways, generally keep it from reaching a paralysis. And we can kind of force our way through, and I give a number of historical examples how NATO would have been a total failure if the U.S. had not, behind closed doors, gotten everybody together and said, look, boys, it's time to do it this way. And the Europeans have, over the years, I've been lectured by European officials at fairly high levels that maybe our president wouldn't behave that way and it would undercut it. So it's a kind of thing where people understand informal rules, but we have to keep the formal rules of everybody tries to play by them. And what's different now is this view that we are kind of a traditional empire that can dictate to everyone else. And by dictating, we, at an exponential rate, decrease our power.
Well, I think what you're saying, though, in your book is that that everybody has underestimated the enormous power of the United States and its power to last, because it is such a phenomenon in terms of history. There's nothing like it. But how do you balance the power of the United States against the growing anti-Americanism? In other words, I know we're talking about two separate things. We're talking about, you know, something that's sort of rhetorical and cultural and political, as opposed to something that is factual, which is the power of the United States. But I don't think you can underestimate anti-Americanism and its growing phenomenon. That seems to be what's happening.
I don't underestimate. I fear it. In fact, I told my co-author that by the time we get this out, it'll be a history book instead of describing the present reality. The point I make in the book is that we don't face a major challenge in the world. China's not going to be an empire that challenges us or a rising power, nor Russia, China, and India together are not. The biggest danger to this empire is incompetent U.S. leadership. Now, I don't have a formula for preventing that. All I can do is describe the structure and how it can be thrown away, and that's what I've tried to do. I don't think it has been thrown away yet. But if we keep on this path and are not willing to eat a lot of humble pie with the United Nations, with the European and other allies, then we will see this power begin to erode fairly soon in the next decade.
And just to quote your book again, you say, gross misuse of military power in parts of the world that promise little return for the effort could erode U.S. hegemony in the world. And President Bush's invasion of Iraq in 2003 and all of the diplomacy related to it appeared to constitute a severe test of this proposition. And, of course, since you wrote this book, things have gotten worse. So let me ask you about how it is that we could have screwed this thing up so badly, given that what a terrible person Saddam was, how desperately the Iraqi people, what straits they were in, how they were obviously incapable of liberating themselves. How could we have not thought about the day after the victory, given that the victory was obviously assured? There was no way the United States was not going to defeat Iraq, having defeated them once. So why did we put all of our focus on a military operation that was a no-brainer and not put any focus on the subsequent part that was obviously turned out to be the critical part?
I wish I knew the answer. I simply do not know it. I was quoted before the war as saying that anybody who believes we'll have a constitutional system in Iraq in the short term, that idea is a joke. Now, why the director of Central Intelligence didn't bring in five or six of the leading comparative politics specialists in the world who studied how constitutional systems come into existence and let them offer judgment on what the prospects were for Iraq, I don't know. One of the more disturbing and, to me, troubling aspects of the run-up to this war was that neither party in the Congress really took this on. The Democrats rolled over and said, oh, yes, we have to get rid of Saddam. The Republicans were eager to get into the fight. Nobody on either side raised these questions. Now, there may have been a few voices. I know at Central Carl Levin, I remember him saying some rather intelligent things about this, but there was no organized group, and we just simply let it go by. And I think that the political elites in both parties, but particularly in this case in the Democratic Party, share a lot of the blame.
And let's then move to the what you're saying lately, which is that the United States should sort of essentially cut its losses and get out, because it's just going to get worse. So the sooner we get smart and get out, the less damage we'll incur. Let's go to the day after then. In that scenario, what, you know, assuming that, I mean, I'm wondering whether or not this administration is as ideological as the critics claim it is, and whether somebody pragmatic like Karl Rove might be saying to the president, look, we're going to lose, we're not going to get a second term unless we ditch Iraq. And I, you know, I'm wondering whether they are capable of declaring victory and pulling out. But let's just deal with the idea of whether or not that happens. What happens on the day after when the U.S., if indeed we decide to cut our losses?
Well, it depends on where you set that date. I haven't written out in any detail what my formula would be for disengagement. I've said it in general terms, and it would be first to go to the United Nations and ask for a resolution to support some kind of military force there and give whatever the Security Council wants to authorize as the basis for the forces and for the makeup of those forces. And in other words, transfer the authority to them in the way we have not. And I suspect that the Europeans might not race in to fill up the vacuum, but they might. I don't know. But I certainly want to give that an opportunity. And I would ask anyone else if they wanted to come in and try to keep this thing from really unraveling. But if they are not, then I would be very clear that I am going to withdraw in a operational way that minimizes the loss to my troops. And the details of that have to be worked out by the Central Command and by through diplomatic channels through other countries, particularly indirectly with Iran, directly with Syria, Turkey, and Kuwait and others. And we just have to go about that. And I would set some rough deadline, 6 to 8 months, to be out completely. I think that will galvanize a completely different view of what we're up against, and a lot of attitudes in the world may change. At that point, being anti-American and standing up and engaging in fits of schadenfreude over the Americans being in trouble would not be so much fun. And I think people would have to really think about what an Iraq in civil war, Iraq broken up into three parts, Iraq dominated in a very tyrannous Shiite regime or a new tyrannous Sunni regime, what that means.
Or a failed state that is a haven for terrorists.
You know. It's already a failed state. I mean, they're all three in failed states. Well, I've already said it'll be, what we've done is make it safe for al-Qaeda. That's done. You see, the point where I find I talk past people on this is they say, well, we can't let that happen. Once you went in, you made that inexorably, you made that outcome inexorable. So you can't get past that. The question is how and at what price you accept the chaos you've created. So it's just going to happen, and it probably will get very, very bad. But I don't see any good reasons for squandering more troops, more resources for another year or two or three before we face that reality.
And they've just asked for another $25 billion on top of the 100-plus billion.
This is a bottomless pit as far as resources are concerned.
Right.
And let me just use an example. We're talking about the technique of understanding how to use U.S. power makes a difference. The first Bush, in 1990-91, raised a coalition of 245,000 troops. Some of those were quite good, not all of them. The only really good forces we have with us over there now have been the Australians, maybe a few Danish and Dutch, and of course a lot of British. But they're a fairly small contingency. But there were many more. They paid their own way in the last affair. In fact, in 1991, we collected over $70 billion from our allies to share the burden, which almost paid for the war. That was because we had the United Nations approval, we had worldwide support on it. In this case, by stiff-arming the Security Council, we are paying people to come into our coalition. We're vastly too short of troops, and the costs are way over $200 billion, and we see no end in sight. So people can say it's idealistic to work through the United Nations. Well, for those who think it's only idealistic, how about doing this little economic calculation or fiscal calculation and see which one you prefer? Getting support through the United Nations, at which makes the price go down, or paying an astronomically larger price and probably losing the whole operation? So that, I think that's an important point to get across now about cost, and particularly when people insist on, say, staying in.
Well, it may be chimeric, though, to expect the United Nations to get in there.
I'm skeptical that the United Nations will be able to find military forces that will go in.
Notion, though, that the United States, since we're already paying the tab for the so-called coalition of the willing, why not hire the Tunisian army, the Egyptians, brigades, the Bangladeshis, even some of the Gujarati Muslim units in the Indian army or the Pakistan army, just get Muslim troops in there, particularly Arabic-speaking ones. Is that another lost leader like the UN? Is that another chimera?
You know, that sounds good, but if you've had to put together multinational forces and get them to cooperate and to be effective, that idea just boggles the mind. A lot of those forces will just end up looting. They'll be more interested in the corruption that they can engage in while they're there than they will doing what they want to do. You can see some of the side effects that you get from that going on in Kosovo right now. Every country has different rules. You can't even operate cross sectors there in an effective way. Therefore, this UN, this military force in Kosovo, multinationals, I think it's six nations have forces in there, just as kind of a cover over a lot of corruption and terrible developments that it won't do anything about. And you would have that squared if you brought in the diverse set of forces you're talking about. Now, if those forces want to go in there and take the responsibility, and if I could match that with my temporarily being with them and then eventually drawing down in over 6 or 8 months, I would certainly accept it. I would have no illusions about the likely efficacy of this in stabilizing the situation and putting a reasonably effective government in place.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Lieutenant General William Odom, who is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a visiting professor at Georgetown University. He formerly served as the director of the National Security Agency from 1985 to 1988 and taught at Yale University from 1989 to 2003. He's also the co-author of America's Inadvertent Empire, a new book from Yale University Press. Just back to the book for a moment. Mao Zedong once had this dictum, which was that it's ideal to have hegemony without responsibility. Is there such a formula? I mean, in a sense, you know.
There is.
I mean, remember what Colin Powell referred to when he tried to warn President Bush about going into Iraq. He said, you know, this is like the pottery barn of international relations. If you break it, you own it.
I think that there's something to that, but. You know, you may own it, but you don't have to try to glue together all the pieces of pottery. You can just junk it and walk away from it. And you leave quite a mess. And I'm not underestimating the mess. And when people disagree with me, because quite a few do, people I respect very much, I can understand why this is the first thought that crosses their mind. We can't leave such a mess there. Well, if you think through that assertion and where it leads you, you realize that sooner or later we will leave that mess. And just because of the structure of resource requirements, et cetera. But back to your point about hegemony without responsibility. One of the remarkable things about this inadvertent empire is that being a community of sovereign states, the U.S. doesn't have the responsibility for the domestic affairs of the country. And that's one of the beauties of it. We are very hard to live with if you're a foreign country and you don't have good laws, stable property rights, and if you abuse your citizens. We'll hector you, we'll badger you, not just the U.S. government, but all sorts of agencies. But if we can do business with you, if we can litigate in courts effectively, and if your citizens are treated reasonably well and ours can be there and under the same rights, then, you know, it works very well, and we jointly make money. You run your affairs. I think the U.S. has wisely stayed out of trying to run people's local affairs to the degree they can. It's this domestic responsibility where I think we really get into trouble with hegemony. There's another kind of a responsibility with hegemony I don't think we can avoid. Let me try to clarify it this way. U.S. forces in Korea and Japan are sometimes looked at as not needed anymore. I think one of the senators out there a few years ago said, let's bring those troops home and put the money in Head Start. Well, if you pull the troops out of Korea and Japan, you can bet the Koreans would rearm and unite against Japan in a minute. And the Japanese would be so disturbed by that that they, too, would rearm and acquire nuclear weapons.
Which they could do very quickly, I believe.
Yes, and the Chinese are not good. They can't sit by benignly and watch that happen. Then you're into an East Asian arms race. Now, how many Japanese businessmen are going to be welcome in China and other Asian countries when a rearmed Japan that's with nuclear weapons emerges on the scene? You could just say goodbye to East Asian economic prosperity. So we may not understand it directly, but the presence of U.S. forces out there is absolutely essential. It's what you read from my text is a kind of a subjective supranational political military governance role. And that role has allowed the wealth in Europe and North America and East Asia to emerge from trade investments from one continent to the other, and all the things we've come to know as the modern economy. And, you know, a lot of my colleagues in political science who subscribe to so-called realism think there's no authority above the nation state. Well, in principle, they're right. But in practice, the U.S. forces and NATO have created an umbrella under which European countries who wouldn't trust each other for centuries will trust each other. If you pull them out, I don't think they'd go to war tomorrow. But the level of mistrust would begin to rise. And where that leads, nobody knows. And those countries in Eastern Europe are most fearful that it would lead to bad outcomes. In East Asia, they know that's the case. That's why the Chinese don't make too much difficulty about the U.S. forces being in that region. They publicly say, well, we should go, but privately they don't. And I was just in China and heard that from President Hu and his predecessor, Jiang Zemin.
Well, General Odom, though, obviously a revolution took place at the end of the Cold War where national threats went away or receded and transnational and subnational threats suddenly emerged. And Al-Qaeda is a kind of virtual state, both transnational and subnational. And it seems that much of the power that we're dissipating with this misadventure in Iraq comes from the White House's essentially their Cold War mentality where they went after a nation state. They couldn't find the virtual state, or they couldn't find bin Laden. So, you know, Saddam had an address. So, I mean, it seems to me that is where the military response to these things appears to be dysfunctional. I mean,
I couldn't agree more. I've characterized that as a total disconnection between our political objectives and our military strategy. And you described it great accuracy. I find that point compelling. I put it this way. We were really at war with Al-Qaeda. They struck us, and when Al-Qaeda struck us, we had lots of support in the world. Over 90 countries signed up to our coalition, five sub-coalitions. There's never been an arrangement like that in diplomatic history, as far as I know. NATO invoked Article 5. It voted that an attack on the United States was an attack on Europe. We would never believe Europeans would support us to that degree. Now, when did that all begin to break down? When we stopped emphasizing Al-Qaeda and said we're going to go to war with Saddam or the Axis of Evil, and maybe the Iranians and maybe North Korea. Our allies, many of them said, wait a minute, we didn't sign up to fight those. We signed up to fight Al-Qaeda. So, in a very brief time, within 2 or 3, 4 months or so, we had thrown great disconsternation into this very pro-U.S. alliance. And as we stubbornly plodded forward to invade Iraq, when most of the people in the world knew that Osama bin Laden would like to overthrow all secular Arab leaders, and Saddam was certainly that we were essentially doing Osama bin Laden's work. The Iranians hate this Saddam's regime with a passion because he invaded them and they fought for 6 or 8 years in the 1980s. So the people most pleased, the people whose objective interests have most been served by the invasion, were the Iranians and Osama bin Laden. So, objectively, this just never was in the U.S. interest. It's highly destructive U.S. power.
And but just in closing, though, General Odom, it seems to me that there's a broader issue here, which is to redefine U.S. power and to reinvent the military, or at least find, I mean, the military are finding themselves in Afghanistan in nation building, and they're trying to build nations in nation in Iraq, but clearly getting nowhere. It seems to me that there has to be some thinking about this, because first of all, where the United States is deficient in both Afghanistan and in Iraq is their inability to deliver the nation-building results.
Okay.
And so why don't we start reinventing things? Maybe there should be a greater role for the Peace Corps. Maybe the whole idea of national security has to be reconfigured.
No, it doesn't. The reason you had to understand. Building nations is something the U.S. Army has been doing since 1776. The Army has spent more time in nation building than any other activity it's ever been in. If you go back and read the manuals that were created down in Fort Bragg during the war in Vietnam, we have endless amounts of material. We know how to do that to a certain degree. We have a civil affairs organization. They were just shoved, all that was shoved aside. Now, no matter how much nation-building practice and capabilities you put together, there are some places where the prospects of succeeding are very, very low. There are countries where it's much higher. You have to choose your battle. Building nations in short order in Iraq is one of the steepest hills to climb. Afghanistan is probably equally steep. We are now committed with the expansion of NATO to this kind of transformation of governments in Eastern Europe. We have on our agenda now a huge nation-building effort. We have it in Bosnia and Kosovo. And I think those endeavors are worth it because the prospects for them becoming fairly liberal regimes, making money, and becoming part of our trading partners is considerable. I don't think that payoff is in sight in 50 years in Afghanistan or even Pakistan or Iraq. Oil money is another question, but that we'll push that aside. Another one. So, this is not a matter of whether we have the capabilities. It's a matter of where and how we decide to employ them. And these people who say, "Well, let's turn it over to the State Department as opposed to the military," they don't know the history of nation building. The State Department is not organized to do that. It never has been. Where it's been done successfully, it's been done by the Department of Defense, the Department of War, much earlier. And the Department of War has always had strong political civilian oversight. So we have a record of knowing how to do that. And we understood that all through the Cold War. We did it badly in a number of cases. But we don't have to reinvent. We have to clear our mind of this confusion that's beset us in the last year or two or three, and go back and get ourselves together and understand the structure of the system we created in the West, which didn't collapse with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and which still requires military power and still requires U.S. leadership, or it will begin to dissolve.
And well, General Adam, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I thank you for joining us. I'd like to follow, I wish we had time to continue this discussion because there's much more I wanted to ask you. Perhaps we can do it again. I thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you. It's been fun.
Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking there with Lieutenant General William E. Odom, is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a visiting professor at Georgetown University, formerly serves as the director of the National Security Agency and is the author of America's Inadvertent Empire. I thank Louis Vandenberg for research and producing this program. I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer.